Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm very excited today to introduce to all of you Michael Moss. He will be my guest, and he'll be coming on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share this week's recipe with all of you. First, I just wanted to share with you that I just got back from upstate New York, where I was attending the NOFA New York annual board meeting retreat. And NOFA New York is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And it's a wonderful nonprofit. It's part of a group of Northeast farming associations. There's one in all of the states in the Northeast. And New York is really working to bring organic food more into the mainstream. They have an incredible certifying program where they certify farms that are organic. And they have an annual winter conference. And this year, like last year, the winter conference will be virtual, which is not, my favorite, because I love gathering and seeing everybody in person, but it's what we needed to make the decision many months ago. And that is what we decided. But there's over 80 workshops that are planned, lots of conferences, breakout groups. So it's still going to be a wonderful event, and you can sign up to join. If you're an organic farm, you can look into NOFA for certification. And also consider joining as a member. During the pandemic, as for so many nonprofits, it's really been difficult. We've lost some staff financially. We're working on things. And so it was a very productive meeting, really great. And I really welcome anybody who's listening to this to consider joining the Northeast Farming Association. It's a really wonderful, wonderful organization. I also want to encourage all of you to go onto my website to sign a petition to help make children's meals in restaurants healthier. I have a petition that was put out from the Center for Science in the Public Interest, which is a wonderful nonprofit group. It's a wonderful nonprofit group. And they are a consumer advocacy organization working to improve our food system to support healthier eating. And right now they're taking on the quality of restaurant meals. And restaurant meals, as you know, have not changed at all. They're hot dogs, hamburgers, pizza, grilled cheese, mac and cheese, soda, everything that we don't want to teach our children to love. But they are foods that kids love. And we'll talk about that later with my guest when Michael comes on. But kids' meals really need to get with the times and really improve. We need to use going out and kids' meals as an opportunity for modeling actually a healthy meal. If the kids don't eat healthy meals at home, what better opportunity than to go out to a restaurant with your parents and be served beautiful vegetables and healthy, greens. And, if they're going to have meat, have a, normal size portion of meat that looks like what it's supposed to look like, not camouflaged in some other form. So anyway, please sign this petition. Let's see if we can help to encourage restaurants to make the children's meals a little bit more current with the times. So many people are really getting on board and starting to eat healthier. Of course, there's many people still that are not, but we need to use restaurants as an opportunity to model healthy eating. And this petition will do that. And there's also a petition to help get PFASs, which are of form of chemicals that are also known as forever chemicals because they don't break down. They don't break down in our bodies or in the environment. And they're found in everything. They're found in our water, in our air, and our food. And small doses of these chemicals are linked to cancer, and they're hormone disruptors. and they've been linked to other diseases as well. And so we need to really encourage the Food and Drug Administration to side with the Environmental Protection Agency, which just came out with a new research paper, really showing the dangers of these chemicals and why they need to get out of the system. And the Food and Drug Administration, under pressure from the food industry, wants to, you know, separate them into different subgroups and allow some and not allow others, which would always allow the food companies to put some sort of chemical in there as a substitute. And we don't want that to happen. We really want them to get rid of all of these PFAS chemicals out of the environment and out of our food. So please sign this petition as well. It's really, really an important one. And then in the news, we've all been, you know, watching the papers and, you know, the climate summit that's been going on in Glasgow has, you know, while it has good intentions, it's really still failing, even with all of the promises and pledges that have been made to reduce emissions. We're still coming up short. Even if everybody does what they say they're going to do, it's still looking like the sea levels will rise. Heat waves, forest fires, droughts will become more regular. The ice sheets are melting. Permafrost thaw will, you know, create those seas to rise, and our whole ecosystem is going to collapse. And we really need to all really take this seriously and care about it and do whatever we can. And, you know, one of the topics in our retreat this past couple of days was how much these climate changes are affecting farmers. And, you know, that's across the country and around the world. And farmers, you know, really need support to try to be ahead of the curve. And also we need to incentivize more farms to become organic, because that is actually has a way of mitigating the problem by sequestering some of the carbon into the soil and helping. So putting energy into organic agriculture is also a plus. So all of that is in the news. I also shared a quick little thing to know your produce. I mean, I have known for years that when you're going to the produce aisle, I always look for items that start with the code 9, because then I know they're organic. If it starts with a 4, it's conventional. But I did not know that there was a code that told you if it was genetically modified, and that starts with an 8. So if you're interested in avoiding genetically modified foods, and you really want to eat well, try to buy foods that start with the 9. That's going to be organic. And now I want to share with you my recipe. The next few weeks, I'm going to be sharing recipes that are great for Thanksgiving. A few years ago, I went fully vegan. I've been vegetarian for so many years, but taking the dairy and eggs out of my recipes was, you know, the last piece that I needed to do. And this vegan pumpkin cheesecake is really, really great. Most of it's raw, actually. It's very similar to the lemon lime raspberry cheesecake I've shared before. And I think you're all going to love this. So the crust is 1 cup of macadamia nuts, 1 cup of almonds, 1 cup of dates, 1/2 cup of dried unsweetened coconut, 1 pinch of sea salt, and 3/4 teaspoon of ground ginger. And then for the filling, it's 3 cups of cashews that you're going to soak in water for 2 to 3 hours, 1/4 cup of lemon juice, 1 can organic pumpkin, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon ginger, 1/4 teaspoon ground cloves, 1/8 teaspoon allspice, 1/8 teaspoon nutmeg, 1/4 teaspoon salt, 3/4 teaspoon cup of maple syrup, 3/4 cup of oil, 1 tablespoon vanilla, and 1/2 cup of water. And then for the topping, 1 cup of pecans chopped fine and 1/4 cup of maple syrup. So you're going to start by pulsing the nuts for the crust in a food processor until they're finely chopped. Add the dates and the coconut and process it a little bit more. Pulse it until it all starts to stick together. from the dates. You can add a pinch of salt to that and some ginger powder and pulse it some more. And then that's going to be the crust. And you're going to use that crust to press into the bottom of a fluted tart pan that has a removable bottom. And press it up along the sides really well. And when you're doing that, you really want to press down, down along the bottom while pressing along the sides so that you don't have a real thick edge where the side and the bottom meets. That's something that happens a lot, and you don't want someone to get a whole mouthful of just the crust. So you need to press down at the bottom and the side where they meet together so that it's really the same thickness as the rest of the crust. Then for the filling, you're going to blend all of the ingredients in the food processor together. Make sure to scrape down the sides and continue blending until it's really smooth, and it should be completely smooth like sour cream. No bumps, no little pieces in it at all. And so just, you know, turn the processor on and just let it go for a while. You can also do it in a Vitamix, of course. Then you're going to pour that filling into the tart pan. And did I say that? Did I mention the can of pumpkin? I almost feel like I left that out. But you're going to put that all into the food processor. Put that into the tart pan and put that into the freezer for about an hour. And then you're going to put the topping on. And that's just the pecans that you're going to pulse into the food processor until they're small pieces. But you don't want to pulse them so that they're that they become a flour. You want them to just be finely chopped. And add the maple syrup to that. And then sprinkle that on top of the cheesecake and replace it back into the freezer. And you're going to remove it from the freezer about 15 minutes before you want to serve it. So it's going to be served cold. And as it defrosts, it becomes really creamy and delicious, and it's just lovely. So enjoy that. And let me know if you do make it. I always love to hear how it is. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Michael Moss. Michael Moss is a journalist and author of a new book that just came out this year called Hooked: Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. And Michael is also the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us, which was an expose of the processed food industry and a number one New York Times bestseller that he published back in 2013. He is a former investigative reporter with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and won a Pulitzer Prize for his explanatory reporting in 2010 for his work on contaminated meat. And he lives right here locally in Brooklyn. And welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Really nice to have you here. So your book is just great. It's a continuation of the first one, but it really gets into more of the nitty gritty and really how the food industry really gets us hooked, similar to the tobacco industry. I just want to step back really from your books first and tell us how you first got involved and passionate about investigating the food industry.
Yes, but I have to ask about that wonderful dog that's walking back and forth. And I'm so sorry your listeners aren't viewers, because what a terrific looking animal.
Thank you. Thank you. That's Leia, Princess Leia. And she's just, nice. She is as wonderful as she looks. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So actually before, you know, I set about, you know, tormenting this $1 trillion processed food industry, I was actually tormenting the Pentagon, because after 9/11, a lot of us became focused on national security issues. And I went to Iraq and I began writing stories about the lack of body armor, vehicle armor for soldiers, because the Pentagon was totally focused on these big defense contractors who wanted to sell them aircraft carriers or jet fighters and cared nothing about the actual soldier and their safety. And so in some ways, coming back home and starting to write about food was like going from one war to another, where again, you have these giant companies being allowed by the government to act in ways that's contrary to our health and our well-being. So there were real strong parallels between those two situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the food industry is certainly one that is much closer to my heart and one that I have I unfortunately, I'm not in a position to torment them like you are, but I wish I was, because they are, you know, an industry I would love to torment, because, you know, I have watched the food industry be so bad for so long, and I've tried to eat well for so long. And, you know, way back when, you couldn't even find organic vegetables in a regular supermarket. You needed to go to a health food store. And by the time you got there, very often they were wilty and looked old. And, you know, so I had to start a food co-op in my house. And, you know, it's been a long journey for me. But the food industry, especially once you start raising kids and you want to eat, have them eat healthy, you know, you can only control them so long. Once they go to school, it's a lost cause. So,
yeah.
Tell us first about your book, Salt, Sugar, and Fat, and how you first got into it there.
Yeah, so I started out writing about food from a food safety standpoint. There were some contamination issues going on. There were peanuts tainted with salmonella that were being used by ingredients by kind of the biggest snack food companies. And I looked closely at that. And then I wrote a story about E. coli in hamburger, because I managed to get my hands on internal documents from Cargill, which kind of for the first time let me write the story about an anatomy of one batch of hamburger that made a lot of people sick, and or put the woman I sort of focused on, Stephanie Smith, into a coma and then paralyzed her from the waist down. And I was continuing to kind of write about food contamination when one of my best sources, who tests meat for the meat industry for E. coli, said to me, you know, Michael, as tragic as these incidents of contamination are, you really should look at the stuff my industry, he's talking about the meat industry now, is intentionally adding to its products, over which it has absolute control. He was worried about all the salt that goes into processed meat, and that got me looking at salt and then sugar and then fat as this unholy trinity, if you will, and on which the largest companies rely on to get us to not just like their products, but to want more and more. And I was incredibly lucky to come across this mountain of emails and strategy papers and memos and texts and stuff from inside the largest companies as they're formulating, marketing, positioning their products. And it was those documents that enabled me to meet key insiders who opened up and revealed even more secrets about how they did it, how they got so many of us to become so dependent on these convenience foods. And that became the essence of Salt, Sugar, Fat, the first book, which came out in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I worked in schools for many years, and we used to encourage parents to bring healthy snacks. And it was a big challenge. But then when those Lunchables came out, you know, the Kraft Lunchables with the little pepperonis that you could put right on the things, and you looked at the ingredient list. And I think a lot of what you're talking about are ingredients that don't even have to be listed on the ingredient list. Is that correct? Or everything?
Yeah,
is
in some cases, listed? In some cases not listed. In some cases, it's the kind of the engineering, it's a use of those ingredients. I mean, there's nothing wrong with salt, sugar, fat in the hands of a cook like you, right? But in the hands of this industry, they're using those three ingredients in ways that go way beyond sort of taste. I mean, I'll just give you one example. At one point, I was focused on salt, and I went to the industry and said, look, so many people are trying to cut back on their salt intake because of the connection to high blood pressure and possibly heart disease. Why can't you guys just reduce the salt in your products? And so Kellogg's, Battle Creek, Michigan, said, hey, come on in. We're going to not just talk to you. We've got a special treat for you. So they made for me special versions of some of their biggest icons in the grocery store, but in this case, without using any salt at all. And I have to say, it was the most god-awful dining experience I ever had, because we started with the Cheez-Its, right, which normally I could eat day in and day out. But these Cheez-Its without salt, we couldn't swallow. They stuck to the roof of our mouth, because for the industry, salt provides texture and solubility. We moved on to the frozen waffles, put them in the toaster, and they came out looking and tasting like straw, because salt adds color, but also taste to an otherwise tasteless industrial product. And then we moved on to the cornflakes. I didn't even know cornflakes had salt in them, but these without salt, we put in the bowl, poured some milk on there, took a bite, and before I could say anything, the chief spokeswoman for Kellogg's is sitting there. She gets this look of horror on her face. She swallows and blurts out, "Metal, I taste metal, M-E-T-A-L. And the chief technical officer, right, who's kind of the scientist in charge of all things scientific and engineering for the company, kind of chuckles and he goes, "Well, that's funny because not everybody will taste that metallic thing in things like cornflakes without salt. But one of the beautiful things about salt for us is that it will mask or cover up some of the off notes, bad taste, that are inherent to many processed foods." And for example, one of the most difficult things for the processed food industry is making products that have meat that then needs to be reheated, because reheated meat, say in a can of vegetable beef soup, takes on the flavor of what the flavorists for these companies describe as wet dog hair. And so you can probably guess what the solution to wet dog hair is if you're making these products. It's dumping more salt in there. And that meeting and that experience that I had at Kellogg's really sort of opened my eyes to the situation where these companies are in some ways are even more hooked on using gobs of those three ingredients and bunches of others we can talk about even more than we are. And as we're going forward now, and people are sort of asking this question, can these giant multinational corporations play, you know, a truly meaningful role in our efforts to eat better going forward? I think that really remains an open question. And they're having a really hard time shaking their own addiction to using those ingredients, because they're so essential to the industrial process of making these foods in ways that you would never need to do in home cooking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know when they first required schools to reduce the sodium intake for so many of those foods and made the food manufacturers come up with alternative chips that were lower in salt, the way they compensated is they upped the sugar. And, you know, because again, they need one of those three ingredients to mask the off flavor.
Yeah, and that gets into a really interesting issue called sort of nutritionalism. And there are some people, and I think they may be right, who sort of argue that we have to be careful when we look at the individual components of food, because the food industry is really good at manipulating its formulas in order to respond to any one concern on our part. And you can kind of look back over time. In the 80s, there's a lot of concern over sugar. And when they started trying to reduce the sugar in some of their products, you know, the companies responded, or in so doing, because their bottom line is they're not going to do anything that's going to reduce the allure, the attractiveness of their products. As you mentioned, what they would do is they're reducing sugar, they're going to increase the fats and the salts in order to maintain that powerful allure of those products. And the 90s, you can come and see that fats became kind of an issue there. And when people were demanding products that had less fat, what the companies did was increase the sugar and the salt. And more recently, decreasing salt. They're doing that, but at the same time, they're increasing sugar in the fats. And so I think we have to be really careful when we look at the nutrition facts label of a product. Stuff that's total junk can look okay when you break it down into its nutritional components. And I think there are kind of bigger questions to ask about what you're eating. And the question is this like real food that I want? Is this real food that's going to be good for me that I really want to eat on a daily basis? And I think if you go beyond those nutritional components.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing, because in our society, in everything, we break things up into little parts. Even the medical industry does that. You know, I remember my husband broke his hand and went to a hand doctor. And it's like, oh no, you need to go to the thumb doctor. You know, I mean, even a hand specialist wasn't enough. You know, everything is compartmentalized and they don't look at the whole, and you need to look at the products as the whole thing. And, you know, I always say, look at the length of the ingredients. Like if I'm making bread, do I put in stabilizers? Do I put in, you know, all those ingredients that are in it? No, I put in, you know, flour, yeast, water, you know, maybe some oil, but maybe not. And that's it. So
yeah, but you know, what's really interesting, it's actually getting harder to go shopping now and sort of tell what's good and bad. And because the industry hears you, it hears our concerns about certain ingredients. So there's been this whole trend in the last 4 or 5 years called the clean label, right? All the companies are trying to shrink their ingredients down to 4 or 5 and get rid of kind of the scarier sounding ingredients. But I think at the end of the day, you still have to look at those products and go, okay, it's only got 4 or 5 ingredients, but, you know, is this real food? Like, what are those ingredients? And they're playing other games too. We're going back to nutritional just for a second. So there's this sense these days that protein can be good for us and help us keep us from overeating, because there's some sense that protein can help us feel fuller faster, right? Well, it's a really difficult thing to do and complicated. It has to do with your whole diet and food environment, etc. But the food companies, knowing that, began going crazy with protein, even to the point where they were adding a few extra grams of protein in a sugary cereal and then splashing the word, you know, extra protein on the front of the label, where so many of us sort of focus, giving us the false assurance that somehow the sugary cereal with a little bit more protein in it is going to help us control our eating habits. So I really empathize with people who are struggling going into the store and trying to figure out, is this like a good product or one I really should be careful about that's going to cause trouble for me?
Yeah. What part does our government play in this, in subsidizing cheap junk food so that junk food ends up being so much more affordable for families that don't have a lot of money versus other food?
Yeah, I was really surprised to find, shocked, I guess, that in so many ways these companies are more powerful than the government agencies that are there supposedly to regulate them on our behalf. I mean, you look at the Department of Agriculture. The vast, vast majority of resources in the Department of Agriculture are geared toward helping the food companies make more money, sell more product here in the U.S. and overseas. And a tiny, tiny fraction is there to advise us on what we should be eating for optimum health. The subsidies that I found that are kind of most significant for the industry, though, aren't coming from government per se. It's the industry's own investment in really growing two things. Field corn, which is not the corn you eat, corn on the cob. It's a different kind of plant that's used for corn syrup and animal feed and ethanol. And then soybeans, because those are kind of the two basic ingredients that go into processed food. And when you look around the country, it was staggering me. I did a piece on this for the Times a few years ago. 90% of the acreage in the United States is planted in field corn or soybeans. And the remaining
90%.
Yeah. And the remaining 10% is like all vegetables and nuts and you know, everything. And frankly, that kind of corresponds to the grocery store too, because you walk into a typical grocery store and only 10% of it is going to be the produce aisle and the nuts aisle, right? And the rest of it is dominated by these sort of ultra processed foods. So the investment being made in agriculture is aimed at reducing the cost and the convenience of field corn and soybean, which then goes on to influence or to reduce the cost and increase the attractiveness of highly processed foods.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you know, I believe you said obesity went from like 40% to 70% in the 1970s. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, no, those numbers are a little wrong. So there's kind of two, and this is, look, this is a crude measure of our sort of loss of control of our eating habits. And I hate to focus too much on obesity because it's sort of based on body mass index. And, you know, that's an even cruder way of sort of measuring health. But what happened is, starting in the 1970s, our obesity rate began climbing to where today, before the pandemic, it hit 42% of American adults. That's almost one in two American adults who are clinically obese, meaning they have 30, 40, 50 extra pounds beyond sort of what they might need for optimum health. So that's one category. But below that, there's another category of Americans who are simply or less dramatically overweight. So that's the category of people who have maybe 5 or 10 or 15 pounds. If you include that, then yeah, we're up to 70% of the American population who are either what is described as being overweight or actually fully obese.
And that, you know, is really tied into when corn syrup, I think, started being added to everything. Would you say?
Yeah, I spent time with the former president of Coca-Cola for North America, South America, who ultimately quit the company and turned around and began working for a farm growing carrots. He became so disenchanted with his role in selling Coca-Cola, not only to Americans, but to people in South America. And, you know, from his vantage point, if you run the numbers and look at the chart, there's almost 100% correlation between our consumption of soda, which shifted from cane sugar, beet sugar, to high fructose corn syrup for various reasons, and the rise in the obesity rate. I happen to think there's probably other factors going on, and it's, you might not want to single out soda necessarily, or even sugar, as the only evil, if you will, to kind of look at in processed food. But what is pretty clear, though, is that our overall dependence on these processed foods has risen hand in hand with not only obesity rate, but type 2 diabetes and other aspects of our trouble with food these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it cracks me up, you know, when you see soda now, out on the, you know, the top, it says, you know, with real sugar, you know, as if that's a plus now, you know, it's like they're marketing made with real sugar, meaning not corn syrup. But yeah, corn syrup is added into everything. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, even you'll find it in organic tomato sauce. I mean, you have to look at the ingredients in everything because they just add corn syrup. It's a cheap sweetener that, they add to everything. And I think a lot of people also have, because it's all that product is genetically modified, unless you're getting organic, you also have that aspect to it as well.
Yeah, and I would sort of argue that, and look, the science is maybe a little iffy on this, but you know, the industry is using, I think at last count, 63 types of sweeteners, not just corn syrup or cane sugar or beet sugar. And so I think you have to be a little careful if you're worried about your sugar consumption, to look sort of carefully at that nutrition facts label, because it may not have corn sweetener. It may have something called, I've forgotten the name now, but it's a densely compacted fruit concentrate sugar, right? That sounds great. It's fruit, but in fact, on a molecular basis, is just another form of sugar. So the industry is really good at maneuvering to avoid our specific concerns. And when we became concerned about high fructose corn syrup, many of the companies scrambled to replace it with another kind of sweetener that wasn't causing alarms in our heads when one could argue they're just as problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The pandemic, you know, certainly shed a light on how diet affects one's immune system and vulnerability to the COVID virus. Can you elaborate at all on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think a lot of us felt that one, maybe the only great thing about the pandemic was that it was going to allow us to escape the vending machine at work, which arguably is one of the most treacherous parts of the processed food industry, right? Normally, usually pure junk. But I think what happened to a lot of people is that we turned our kitchen cupboards into vending machines because we went shopping. And in the fear and the stress of the pandemic, we found ourselves buying things we hadn't had since we were kids. You know, breakfast pastries, chips, cookies, candies, things that we remembered as being incredibly soothing and comforting. And we brought those things home. And not only that, but the company, some of the companies were really good at keeping those shelves stocked. You remember how yeast and flour ran out in many grocery stores? Well, that's because they weren't controlled by the snack food companies. In the case of snack foods that we were buying, the truck drivers who delivered those foods to the stores would go into the stores and stock the shelves themselves to make sure that their stuff was there for us to buy. And I think it was a really telling, it is a really telling example of how so many of us shop and eat sort of based on our emotional connection to food. And the companies are really, really good at sort of tapping into that and exploiting that to their advantage.
Yeah, you actually, get in the book, you talk so much about addiction and how the foods are addicting, and similarly to the tobacco company. Can you talk about that correlation?
Yeah, and if we'd had this conversation 5 years ago before I started the research for my new book, Hooked, I would have said that's like totally ridiculous to compare Twinkies to heroin, right? For lots of reasons we don't have time to go into, but I've completely sort of turned around, changed my mind on that. I'm now convinced that many of these products for many people are even more trouble than tobacco, alcohol, and even some drugs. And that it's totally fair to sort of call these products addictive in the sense that they're engineered in ways that destroy our free will, our ability to sort of say no, to stop, to think about the long-term consequences of what we're doing. But one of the most kind of telling aspects of looking at this whole subject area for me was spending time with brain scientists who are also evolutionary biologists. And one of my favorite people in Hooked is a neuroscientist named Dana Small. She was trained at McGill and she's now at Yale. Dana was the first person who figured out how to look at the brain activity when we're eating, because she is a self-professed chocoholic. And so she realized that she can slide people into the brain scanner where you have to remain perfectly still, right? You can't chew in the brain scanner, but she could put milk chocolate on their tongues and it would just melt on its own in the warmth of their mouth, and she could see the brain respond to that. So it's fabulous work that Dana was doing. But she said to me at one point, and because I was asking her about whether she views kind of modern processed food as being addictive, and she goes, I mean, kind of from my perspective, it's not so much that we're addicted to food, it's that we by nature are drawn to food in ways that attract us to food. And the nature of our food has changed so dramatically in the last 50 years that our biology hasn't had a chance to kind of catch up with that. And so things that used to be good for us in terms of attracting us to food are now sort of problematic. And so, for example, we by nature love food that's cheap. If you go back to hunter-gatherer societies, it made a lot more sense when you're looking for dinner, instead of chasing, trying to run down an impala, to just grab that poor aardvark that's sitting there, because that means less energy expenditure on your part. And that's a really important thing for us. Well, come forward to today, the companies exploit that by finding really clever ways to reduce the cost of their products, knowing that we'll get excited about them. They have chemical laboratories working for them, whose job it is to kind of mix and match chemicals to mimic the real flavors and tastes in food. But their primary mission for the companies is to mix and match these chemicals in a way that reduces the cost of the food. Because the companies know if we go into the grocery store and that box of breakfast pastries costs 15 cents less than it did the week before, our instinctual reaction to that is going to be to get excited because we love inexpensive food, meaning food that requires less energy expenditure on our part. Another basic instinct we have is that we're attracted to variability. Humans are incredibly adaptable in diet. It's why we were able to spread across the globe and live in places like the Arctic, where the only thing we had to eat was whale blubber, and we would fall in love with whale blubber, right? So how does the industry deal with that, respond to that? That's why you walk into the cereal aisle, and there are 200 versions of sugary starch. The industry knows that we will get excited just by that, in this case, pretense of variability. It's what kind of what they call the smorgasbord effect, where you're going through the Chinese buffet line and a second time and you're already full, but you see new items and it's irresistible. You're going to put those on your plate and eat them even though you're full. And the last thing that we have by instinct is that we by instinct love calories. And when you think about it, it made total sense, right? Back in the day, getting enough calories was a matter of life and death. And so we developed sensors in our gut, possibly even in our tongue, that tell us how many calories there are in the food that we're eating and we're drinking. And so what did the industry do? They started creating these snacks, these highly processed food products that are loaded with calories, but devoid of any real nutritional value. And so the situation we have is that we get excited by the calories, but we don't have the biological mechanisms in order to realize that those food products have no nutritional value for us. So those are just kind of three ways that the industry not only is formulating these products using things like salt, sugar, fat in very precise ways, but they're also tapping into our basic instincts that draw us to food in a way that's become really problematic in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. I actually am surprised when you're saying that we're attracted to calories, because I always hear everybody trying to like reduce their calories. And so they're always, you know, picking up, oh, this one's, you know, no, contains no sugar, or, you know, it's a diet thing, because people are aware of calories, at least now, and are trying to reduce the calories. And so they're grabbing foods that are even worse for them. Like, I was up in arms when, you know, California, different states were trying to pass the soda law and make sugary sodas heavily taxed and not diet sodas. And for me, I was feeling like diet soda is worse for you than sugary soda. I mean, it's so unhealthy. So what do you think about that?
Right. So, but that thinking is in the part of the brain, the frontal cortex, right? Which scientists like to divide the brain into two, right? There's the stop brain. That's the part of the brain where you're going, hey, wait a minute, is this really good for me? Do I really want to be doing this? What are the long-term consequences? But a large part of your brain is what scientists call the go brain. It's the primitive, instinctual part of our brain that says, go, do this. We want this. And so much of the processed food is designed in a way to maximize, excite the go brain and put the stop part of our brain to sleep. So yeah, if we really have that chance to sort of stop and go, wait a minute, do I really want all these calories? Fine. But on an instinctual basis, our love for calories is what's driving us toward those products. And if you're somebody who gets cravings, and again, this is one of the lessons I learned from looking at the world of other addictive substances like tobacco, alcohol, and drugs. If you're someone who gets cravings for sugary foods, that craving is so powerful in hindering your ability to think about what you're doing and put the brakes on overeating, that you'll be off and running to grab that product before you can sort of put the brakes on and give that some thought.
Mm-hmm. And did you come up with or figure out any way to counteract that craving? I mean, like, how do people get that stop back in line?
Yeah. So, I mean, first thing, obviously, as a journalist, I mean, I think the first thing you need to do is just know all the tricks that the industry is using. And that's, you know, knowledge is power. But what people who work in drug addiction will tell you is that because that craving is so powerful and overwhelms your ability to sort of deal with it. If you're somebody who has just, you know, a 3 p.m. craving for a cookie, you need to be executing whatever your strategy is for dealing with that, whether it's to like get up and stretch or take a walk around the block or call a friend. You need to be executing that before the craving comes on at like 2:45 in order to get ahead of it. And so somebody who's trying to change their eating habits in a significant way, you have to have a plan, and you have to be sort of on that plan from the minute you wake up in order to sort of develop these better eating habits and ward off those moments of addiction that we call the cravings, which blind you to what your goal is.
Mm-hmm. And what about the marketing that food industry does? You know, they so clearly market to children, to the Latinx community, the Black community, you know, with certain foods. Can you talk a little bit about the marketing element of these food companies?
Yeah, so I sort of argue in Hooked, because I concluded that in some ways these food products are even more trouble than tobacco, alcohol, and drug, kind of for two reasons. And one of those is the power of memory in shaping our eating habits, right? From the time we're a very young age, possibly even from the time we're in the womb, depending on what our mother is eating, we're developing likes and dislikes for food based on what we're given to eat. And we retain those memories for the rest of our life. You remember that Kellogg's factory? So we were talking about salt. But when I went into their research and development factory, they were experimenting with some new development in Pop-Tarts, right? And it had messed up, and they were dumping a huge amount of Pop-Tart dough into a big bin for disposal. And the aroma came wafting across the factory floor. I hadn't had a Pop-Tart in decades, since I was a latchkey elementary kid, and I would come home and let myself in home and put a Pop-Tart strawberry in the toaster oven. I hadn't had a Pop-Tart since then, but just that aroma took me instantly back to those days, because the aroma was triggering the memory of Pop-Tarts, which never left my head. And so what the food industry is all about is, one, planting those memories in us by getting us to sort of habitually eat their products at a really young age, and then triggering those memories through advertising and marketing, what psychologists call cues. And they're so powerful. And the deeper our memory channels are, having been deepened by kind of habitually going back and eating those same products, the more ready we are to get excited when we see the advertising for the products. And so that's why, you know, the soda companies, Coke and Pepsi, have spent so much effort trying to get a soda in the hands of a kid when they go to the ballpark with their parents, because not only do kids form really strong memories for food, but they tend to associate those memories with other really great emotional aspects. And in this case, a kid getting a soda at the ballpark with their parents is forever more going to associate that soda with that joyous moment. And so dial forward to adulthood, you need some joy and comfort in your life, you're going to think of soda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I have that with ice cream. My father loved ice cream. And so no matter what the occasion was, you know, a school concert, a family gathering, whatever, it always ended up like piling into the car and driving to Carvel, which was down the road, you know, getting ice cream. And it was a really tough one to break, you know. And I mean, I still drive by Carvel and kind of like have a memory of my father. It's just so strong. And they actually say the sense of smell also was one of the strongest senses. And so when you talked about the aroma coming, you know, I can imagine, you know, I would have had that too. I mean,
yeah, well, actually, so it turns out, and you probably know this, that I think the figure is something like 70 or 80% of what we call taste is actually coming from smell, right? And it's really incredible when you look at that. And it's one of the ways our evolution has sort of changed us in terms of our dealings with food. But, you know, walking upright fully developed the nasal cavity and created kind of this chimney effect at the back of our mouth. And so when we chew food, it releases aroma volatiles that go to the back of the mouth and then go up into the nasal cavity and trigger the olfactory bulb, which is sitting right below the brain. But it's really fascinating that basically, so there's five tastes that we have, right? Salt, sweet, bitter, umami, what am I forgetting? Sour, right? Five basic tastes, but there's several hundred individual smells that we can identify. And we have many more smell sensors in the olfactory bulb than we do taste buds on the tongue. And so flavorists, people who study food, have realized, again, that 70% of what we call taste, right, is actually coming from the smell of foods, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah. Another thing that I know I have found out and, you know, is so disturbing, you know, I always tell people follow the money because, you know, these corporations, they're in it for making money. And, you know, their success is how much they can give to their shareholders. Well, here they do all this work to get us addicted to these unhealthy foods and get us fat. But how much money are they now investing in diet companies, right? They're all buying up these diet companies. And, you know, so here they're making money on getting us fat, and then they're trying to make money on getting us skinny. It's sick.
Yeah, that was an aspect of the last book, Hook, that actually truly shocked me. So not only are they engineering their products with perfect amounts and combinations of salt, sugar, fat, and not only are they exploiting our basic instincts that used to be good for us and attracting us to food and now are problematic because the way the industry uses and creates its products, but they're also exploiting our attempts to regain control over our eating habits. So unbeknownst to me, and I think a lot of people, that back in the 70s when we began dieting in desperation to regain control, the biggest processed food companies began buying up the most popular dieting methods. And it started with Heinz, the now Heinz Kraft, purchasing none other than Weight Watchers. And then it spread around the industry where you had Nestle and Unilever buying Nestle Craig and et cetera, and all these sort of brands. But then the companies also moved into the grocery store and started creating diet versions of their mainline products so that you would stand at the freezer aisle and there would be Nestle's Hot Pockets. And then right next to it would be the Lean Pockets. And when you really look at those two products, there isn't a whole lot of difference between them. And for the company, it's all good, because no matter what you choose that particular moment, whether to buy the Hot Pocket or the Lean Pocket, and I think there's sort of some science saying that what we end up doing is like moving back and forth depending on our vulnerability and stress level, et cetera. It doesn't matter the company, you're still buying, you know, one of their products. And of course, dieting overall is so problematic for people. And before I forget, I want to mention this, which is one of the ways that sort of our natural biology is now turned upon us by the companies is in fact body fat. So for most of our existence, body fat was a really great thing. It enabled us to get through hard times, you know, famine. It enabled our brain to grow. It enabled us to have more babies, more offspring, right? Well, so for that reason, body fat developed some really interesting skills in order to protect itself from shrinking, right? So dial forward to today, endocrinologists who study, you know, how hormones and other hormones and other systems in our body that help us communicate with different parts of our body have discovered and realized that body fat is a living, thinking organ like other organs in their body. And it communicates with the rest of our body, right? And its sole mission in life is to prevent you from messing around with it. So if you've gained 15 pounds or 20 pounds, that extra body fat has been working day and night to prevent you from getting rid of it. And it does so in two ways. One, it sends signals to the brain telling you you're hungry when you're really not hungry, so you eat more. And two, it reduces your resting metabolism. So you're burning less energy just sitting around and sleeping. And so you're less of a threat to that body fat. So knowing that now, I am so much more empathetic with people who are trying to lose weight, realizing that it's their own body working against so hard against them now to either prevent them from losing that weight or to get them to put the weight back on once they do lose it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Michael, I just have to thank you for your work. It is really phenomenal. It's so important. And everybody, you need to get this book and read it because, you know, you need to know how these food companies are manipulating us so that you can get back your power and, you know, combat it on your own because it's, you know, our government's not helping us and the, you know, regulation's not helping us. You know, anytime you have an opportunity to, you know, sign a petition, try to make our companies, you know, like I was talking about at the beginning, the Environmental Protection Company is saying to, you know, remove the PFASs and the Food and Drug Administration doesn't want to because they have pressure from the food companies. So it's a really tough situation, but we all need to stand strong. And Michael, just thank you so much for your work. It's phenomenal. Everybody sure. Get the book Hooked and read it. And thank you again, Michael, for joining me. And everybody out there who's, thank you. And everybody that is out there listening to us today, thank you for joining us. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.